Hello and welcome to this special conversation hosted by Reaction. I'm Max Mitchell, political reporter and podcast producer here at Reaction, and with me today to discuss his new book is author and journalist James Kaplan. James has been writing important biography, journalism and fiction for more than four decades, and he has previously written the two-volume biography of Frank Sinatra, and his latest book is called Three Shades of Blue, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Bell Evans and the Lost Empire of Cool. He's with us today to talk about that lost empire. James, welcome.
I'm delighted to be here, Max. Thank you.
It's been a long time coming. The book is fabulous. It's a huge achievement. It's a wide-ranging book, almost a tome, if you will. The focus is Miles Davis' 1959 album Kind of Blue and the 60 years of jazz and American culture that lead up to that moment. You spend a fair amount of time in the exposition and how these musicians come to meet each other and afterwards and where they go and where their lives take them. So these are extremely well-documented musicians in jazz and just in music in general. Why did you feel it necessary to write this book? What story did you want to tell?
Well, I met with my book editor, Scott Moyers, about 6 years ago, trying to think up a new idea for me. He thought that it would be interesting to write a book about Kind of Blue, the best-selling and arguably best-loved jazz album of all time. And I told Scott that there was already a quite excellent book, Ashley Kahn's book, about the making of Kind of Blue. But I instantly thought of one of the very first magazine profiles I ever did, a Vanity Fair profile I did in 1989, of Miles Davis. And I had the vast good fortune to be able to sit down for several hours with Miles Davis. And though I was a very ignorant young man at the time, he was very kind to me and indulgent of my questions. And so I kind of had this interview in my pocket. I had my encounter, my real life encounter with this legend, with this icon in my pocket. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to write not just about the album Kind of Blue, but about the three geniuses of that album, Miles and John Coltrane and Bill Evans, as men and musicians before, during, and after the making of the album.
And I think it comes together really, really well. I think Ashley Kahn's book's great, but as you see, it is a little bit specialised and it really only focuses on that album, and there really is, it's such fertile ground for exploration. There's so much going into it, there's so many influences, there's so much history and culture that lead up to that moment and indeed what that album then goes on to influence. How long did it take you to write this book?
All in, Max, about 5.5 years.
Right, okay. A proper undertaking then.
Yes. And my editor was Scott was very determined that the book fall just under tome length, which he set at 500 pages. So the book had to come in sub 500 or else. And I did it.
So you start the book with a chapter about Miles's relationship with his mentee Wallace Roney, who you had a brief relationship with. It seems that you got to meet him and talk to him and ask him about Miles. And it seemed that the whole of the recording industry wanted Miles to love Wynton Marsalis, and he instead loved Wallace. What were you trying to communicate? And you also talk about your relationship with Miles Davis, and it's really interesting, that anecdote of you going to interview him a couple of times. Could you explain what you were trying to do with opening the book in this way, this anecdotal way? And it really works, but what were you trying to get across about Miles Davis, this great architect of music, this great genius?
Yes, and geniuses are also human beings. And I think if I do anything somewhat well, it is delving into the psychology of my subjects. I wrote two volumes about Frank Sinatra, and I I was annoyed before I began the Frank Sinatra project by the fact that everything written about him seemed to be about the women and the mob and the fist fights. I was more interested in him as a human being and as a musical genius. And I was interested in Miles Davis. Miles Davis, a not dissimilar character to Frank Sinatra in some ways, and they knew each other a little bit, by the way. Both small men, short and slight, and somewhat on the defensive. Both fancied themselves boxers, and both, I would guess, I know that Frank did when he was a boy, and I'm positive Miles did, felt they had heard the music of the spheres. So Miles was not only a genius, he was a man, he was a human being. I felt this acutely when I met with him. I wanted to learn more about Coltrane and Evans as human beings. And so I wanted to take this book, despite the fact that many, many thousands of words had been written about all three as musicians and their music. I was equally interested in their psychology and in their emotionality and what caused them to make the moves they did in jazz. And I got very interesting and unexpected answers about all three of them.
Well, the psychological investigations and the psychological criticism that you engage in, it really does come across. You do feel that we are diving into the personalities that might make music like this. And we'll return to those characters in a little bit, but I'd like you to situate for us and the listeners in the early, mid, and late 40s. Where is jazz? What's happening with it? What is this thing called bebop that Train, Miles, and Evans are all inspired by as young men? What's happening there?
Jazz was undergoing very radical change in the 1940s, from the early 1940s into through the end of World War II and past it. And World War II, in several different ways, really ended the big band era, the swing era, because it became financially, it became economically unfeasible to field big bands, to support big bands with all the rationing on gasoline and the bans on transportation, and just the general lack of money in the business and the change in popular tastes. And it wasn't just Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker. There were a number of other young, brilliant black jazz musicians who contributed to the foundation of bebop. But this new music sprang up. Thelonious Monk famously said, "We wanted a music that they couldn't understand." And everybody knew what Thelonious Monk. Everybody thought they knew what he was saying when he said that. They thought he was talking about white people, old-fashioned people, big band people. He was talking about all of the above. Jazz musicians, young jazz musicians in the 1940s wanted to make it new. And so this new music of incredible rhythmic complexity and harmonic complexity sprang up, and jazz in almost overnight, but certainly over the years of the end of the war and just beyond, turned from dance music into listening music. It was music. Bebop was never going to be music that people could dance to. You had to stand or sit and listen to it. And a lot of people rebelled against that. Certainly a lot of the old guard in jazz detested it and detested that change. That's always going to happen with old guards and avant-gardes. But it was irreversible. The new music came in, and the new geniuses came in, and Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie became the twin gods of the new music.
It's fascinating that change from dancing music to listening music, this change in the art, this Ezra Pound call to make it new. And it's so interesting that these young men, Miles and Coltrane, were totally gobsmacked by this. They'd, spent their young lives just in the kind of implicit acknowledgement that music was something that you heard in big halls and danced to. And even as young men, they played with big bands. They kind of saw the last of that. What was
Yes.
their early artistic output like? How was it influenced by play, serving your time in big bands?
Well, it was more the case with Coltrane than it was with Miles. Miles played with some largish bands in St. Louis, where he grew up. But Miles had his Damascene epiphany, if you will, when the great Billy Eckstein, the great vocalist Billy Eckstein, brought his big band to St. Louis, along with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, who were in the band. And the band, Eckstein's band, was playing a lot of dance music, but Eckstein had big ears. He, alongside his commercial instincts, he had artistic instincts, and he was interested himself in the new music. And so he let Dizzy and Bird play a few of these new numbers, new style numbers, along with the dance music. Miles Davis gravitated to the club where Billy Eckstein's band was playing, and he got to sit in with them, and he got to meet these idols of his, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, who told Miles, and by the way, at this point, Miles is all of, I think he was just 18, maybe even 17 years old. Bird and Diz say to Miles, to this kid, next time you're in New York, look us up. Well, you know, that's kind of party talk, probably, but Miles took it literally. And when he went to New York to enroll at Juilliard, this is how he got his father, who was a successful dentist in St. Louis, to support his trip to New York. He almost instantly began to play hooky from Juilliard and did indeed make contact with Bird and Diz. And then, to his astonishment, was hired by Charlie Parker, to the astonishment of everybody, really. Coltrane was a different story. Coltrane, yes, played in a lot of dance bands. And Coltrane was the emotional opposite of Miles in many ways. Coltrane was intensely private, quiet, shy, and inclined to hide his considerable light under a considerable bushel. And so he really spent the first 10 years of his artistic development, say from 1944 until the mid-50s, playing in a lot of R&B bands with the likes of Eddie Cleanhead Vincent. These weren't huge bands, but they were 10, 12, 14 people, and they were playing R&B. And Coltrane very frequently found himself, to his huge embarrassment, having to actually, they called it walking the bar. And it was literally that. They would play, these R&B bands would play saloons, and Coltrane, with his tenor saxophone, had to play it as he walked along the bar. And very, very humiliated by having to do that, but that was the gig.
And so you can't really imagine a jazz deity, a jazz musician, less suited to walking the bar than John Coltrane, who would go on to make serious, serious music. What was Bill Evans like as a young man? Where does Bill Evans come from? Who is he?
Bill Evans could have been a concert pianist in the Western classical tradition. He was a highly skilled and sensitive pianist, but a strange thing happened to him, maybe the equivalent of what happened to a lot of would have been serious in so-called serious musicians in the rock era. Bill Evans, though he was training to become a concert pianist, fell in love with jazz, and as a teenager became the fastest boogie-woogie player in New Jersey. He went to college in Louisiana to, again, study Western classical and to train to be a concert pianist, but his love of jazz just overtook him. And soon after he graduated, he went to New York City with the aim of making it in jazz or bust. He was either going to make it in jazz or go home. And he played a lot of dances, a lot of weddings, a lot of bar mitzvahs. He also got a gig, it was around 1955-56, at the Village Vanguard on Lower 7th Avenue in Manhattan, playing in between the sets of an extremely successful band at the time, an extremely successful jazz quartet for all time, the Modern Jazz Quartet, who were headlining at the Vanguard. And in between their sets, Bill Evans would play solo piano. And while the Modern Jazz Quartet was playing, the patrons of the Village Vanguard would go dead silent. And when they were through and on their break and Bill Evans began to play, the patrons of the Village Vanguard would begin to rattle their china and glass and silverware and talk amongst themselves. But one night, while Evans is playing during one of these breaks, through all the noise, he looks down at the end of his grand piano, and there are the penetrating eyes of Miles Davis fixed on him. Miles was there. He was hearing Bill Evans, and he was hearing something brand new in jazz piano. Bill Evans, again, highly attentive to the Western classical canon, and in love with the moderns and the impressionists, with Shostakovich, with Stravinsky, with Rachmaninoff, with Ravel, and was bringing these colors and these harmonies and these musical textures into his playing. And these, in fact, were composers that Miles Davis was listening to as well. And so Miles was fascinated, and a week later, to Evans's utter disbelief, his phone rang, and it was Miles saying, "Join my band." And when Miles said, "Join my band," you joined Miles's band, and Evans did.
Yes, and that's really interesting, their common love of European classical music. And I love that part of your book where you say that, and you kind of digress from Miles's autobiography, co-written with Quincy Troup, who many think, you know, maybe might have written more of the book than Miles did and forced his certain opinions into it, but that Miles Davis was interested in Western white classical music. He didn't think that there was anything off limits. You were supposed to learn from everything. If you were to be a true artist, you were to be voracious, and you were to take it all in as much as you could. And I think it's maybe what all the three share, Evans, Coltrane and Miles, that really there's not any sound that isn't worth making a judgment on and learning from, really. They seem to be very open musicians.
Yes, vast musical curiosity, and you're right. No inhibitions, no limits. Whatever it was they were hearing, they brought it to the music. A lot of black jazz musicians felt either consciously or unconsciously, either vocally or silently, that if you played classical music, that you were limited to that. That if you learned to read music, for example, that would limit you. They felt that it was instinctual. There was a lot of limited thinking among black jazz musicians, and Miles wanted no part in that. He wanted to hear everything. A thing that was a huge turnaround influence for him in the late 50s was going to see Les Ballets Africains, this dance troupe from Africa, who brought along not only amazing dancing and amazing drumming, but also their musical backing was finger piano, African kalimba. And so Miles, who was feeling more and more as though jazz needed to be simplified and constructed of fewer chords than it had been being constructed, loved the sound of this ballet music and the African finger piano. That was a big influence for him.
Mm. And Miles's music is changing even from the time of Charlie Parker's death and the birth of the Cool Sessions. And what happens to Miles in the first half of the 50s? What happens to his career from birth of the Cool or Charlie Parker dying up until Newport? What happens to Miles?
Well, just to step back, maybe one and a half steps, Miles had become a very serious heroin addict in 1949. This was after he had gone to Paris and encountered a brand new atmosphere of being respected as a human being and as a man without any regard to the color of his skin. But then had to return to America, where he was, as he saw it, and as unfortunately was the case, just another black man, another Negro in America in the late 40s. And he was so depressed that he fell into this cult, this myth-driven cult of, which was really not consciously initiated by, but inspired by Charlie Parker. Charlie Parker, of course, was a gargantuan heroin addict. And the myth sprang up in the late 1940s that if you wanted to play like Bird, if you wanted to play that brilliantly, you had to do like Bird. You had to do heroin. Miles got dragged into heroin, which was the bane of his existence for 5 years. He finally kicked. There was a man at Columbia Records. Columbia was the biggest label in America and the biggest jazz label in America. And the head of jazz at Columbia was a man named, wonderful man, who I got to know a little bit, named George Avakian. And George Avakian had, Miles had pestered, been pestering Avakian for years to sign him, Miles, to Columbia. And Avakian didn't want to because Miles was a heroin addict and thus he was unreliable. And he also felt that Miles was too interested in bebop, in fast jazz. And he saw Miles as ultimately and definitively a great ballad player. But he wouldn't sign him. He wouldn't sign him because he was a heroin addict. Then Miles kicks the drug. He goes to play at Newport Jazz Festival in 1955, and Avakian is there. And signs Miles to Columbia Records, and this is a huge sea change in Miles' life and in his career.
And he goes on to make great records at Columbia, Roundabout Midnight, Milestones, that comes a little bit later, but he makes some big band records that are really quite unique with Gil Evans, doesn't he? How important is Gil Evans in Miles' story?
Well, Gil Evans and Miles came together around the time that Miles first came to New York. And Gil Evans was white, he was Canadian, and he was astonishing to Miles because, and perhaps because he was Canadian, there was none of this baggage of Jim Crow, of anti-Black prejudice at all. Miles had extremely sensitive antennae to racial prejudice. Gil Evans was without racial prejudice. Gil Evans was an extremely gifted composer and arranger, and he loved to talk music with Miles, and Miles felt the same way. So they struck up this very strong friendship and musical partnership that really culminated in the late 1940s, early 1950s, with the birth of the Cool Sessions. These nonettes that were written and arranged by Evans and several other wonderful jazz composers of the time, the likes of Johnny Carisi and George Russell, and made these albums that took jazz in an entirely different direction. Then, when Miles signed with Columbia, he and Gil Evans began to work together again, and they made Porgy and Bess, and they made Sketches of Spain together. And these albums were controversial to a certain extent. There were jazz heads, there were jazz addicts who preferred Miles improvising to Miles playing from charts. But I think those albums that Miles did with Evans are undeniably great and undeniably influential, even unto the present day.
They are still so fascinating. It feels like they are evergreen. You always hear some new musical ideas in it that you never previously heard, no matter how many times you listen to it. So Miles is signed to Columbia. He's trying to get his band together. How does the Kind of Blue band come in? Because with heroin addictions, with personality clashes, the world of jazz is chaotic. So much changes. Everyone wants to be a leader. Everyone wants to be performing their own music. They think they might get a record deal here and there. They might go on tour. So much can change. So how does the Kind of Blue band come together?
Well, it was all very kind of amazing. I think of this wonderful solar eclipse I saw yesterday, and how sometimes three bodies or even more can line up in space. You had, as you say, quite correctly, all this chaotic situation in jazz and all these chaotic changes that everybody was constantly making. Miles hires John Coltrane in 1956, to everybody's astonishment. Everybody was as amazed and nonplussed as they were when Charlie Parker hired Miles back in the 1940s. Nobody had heard of Coltrane at that point. Not only that, Coltrane was a heroin addict himself. And in short order, despite Miles's vast musical respect for Coltrane, he had to fire him because Coltrane, being an addict, was just unreliable. So he fires Coltrane, and there are various personnel changes in Miles' band. Miles' favorite drummer of all time was the great Philly Joe Jones. And as one of my many interviewees told me, interviewees for this book told me, Philly Joe Jones was the Babe Ruth of heroin. He was the maestro of heroin. And so when Miles first hires Bill Evans to play in his group, Philly Joe is still the drummer. And there's a lot of, despite the fact that Miles had fired Coltrane, he hired him again when Coltrane became clean. And again, all these moving parts, moving and moving and moving. And so there is a sextet with Miles, a quintet, I should say, with Miles. And Coltrane is back after he's kicked heroin, but there's Philly Joe, who's a heroin addict. And Bill Evans finds himself hired by Miles Davis and instantly subject to, they used to call it Crow Jim. This is reverse prejudice and just as biting and terrible and by Black audiences and Black musicians against Bill Evans for being the only white member of the biggest small jazz band in America, Miles Davis's band. And Bill Evans, who was this sort of nerdy guy from New Jersey with glasses and a professorial mien, very quickly becomes friends with Philly Joe Jones and sets about becoming the biggest junkie in the group. This is a sort of side issue, but not entirely a side issue, because it's going to affect the entire rest of Evans's life and career. Miles has to fire Philly Joe for being a heroin addict. And the band that comes together for Kind of Blue is Miles and the clean, now clean, John Coltrane, the using Bill Evans, who, and this is maybe too much information, but Evans had already quit Miles the year before because he was burned out, but Miles wanted to do something very specific with this new album. And I'll talk about that in a minute, but he needed Evans to do that thing. So he hires Evans back. He has Coltrane clean. He has a very fine jazz drummer, Jimmy Cobb, who never used drugs. He has Paul Chambers, a great bassist, who unfortunately happens to be an addict and an alcoholic as well. And he has the wonderful, wonderful Cannonball Adderley, who had nothing to do with drugs, was just a great alto saxophonist, so soulful, and such an amazing counterpart to Coltrane. And so there are all the components. Miles has this complicated and brilliantly inventive pianist in the form of Bill Evans. He has the great Coltrane, he has the great Cannonball Adderley, he has Paul Chambers, who's a wonderful bassist, he has Jimmy Cobb, and he has this this amazing sextet. So all the pieces, again, like the celestial bodies in an eclipse or something like that, they all line up to produce this piece of musical magnificence that really is created beforehand in the head of Miles Davis. Miles very strongly imagined what he wanted to do with Kind of Blue. Afterwards, he actually felt that he had failed. A lot of people seem to disagree with that because this album is so wonderful and so enduring.
Yes, I think we would all have to disagree with Miles on that. I think we would have to say he was wrong on that call. So it really is a miracle that this band comes together at all. It always amazes me reading the story of that album. And so, 1959, it's the climax of the book, the year Lester Young and Billie Holiday die. Jazz is moving on. Rock and roll is starting to be heard on the radio. It's at the end of Eisenhower's second term. The space race is on. the United States recognizes the new Cuban government of Fidel Castro. The civil rights movement is in full swing. This is a noisy world. It's crazy, isn't it? So how does this all play into Kind of Blue?
Well, it is a Kind of Blue is this. It is like a hiatus in time. It is a moment of zen-like silence in between the old world and the new world. This new world is rapidly rushing in with intercontinental ballistic missiles, with the Boeing 707. Suddenly you can fly in mere hours to other continents, and missiles can fly to other continents as well. You're right, rock and roll is on the horizon. So many things are about to happen. But Kind of Blue is just this island of calm. It is a moment of timelessness in the midst of this dizzying change. And Miles and all the rest of the members of his band would proceed onward in different directions after the album. And 1959 was also an amazingly fertile and a disruptive year in the history of jazz. It was an epoch-making year in the history of jazz. You had not only Kind of Blue, you had Mingus Aum, Charles Mingus's transformational album. You had Dave Brubeck's Time Out with Take Five and all the strange time signatures. And then you had the great Ornette Coleman and the shape of jazz to come. And the shape of jazz to come in Ornette Coleman's hands was this new thing that was called free jazz. And free jazz was an altogether different direction in jazz. It was taking jazz into stratospheres that it had never reached before. It was taking jazz from, it had gone from a dance music to listening music. And suddenly it was an extreme art music. And a lot of people went along with it and were fascinated and stimulated by it. And a lot of people were put off by free jazz. But suddenly jazz was less and less the music of the masses, less and less radio music, and more and more art music after 1959. And yet we have Kind of Blue, this hushed, majestic masterpiece.
It's so interesting to think of Kind of Blue as this liminal bridge from old world to new. And I suppose that year in jazz is as well, because I might be wrong, but I think Art Blakey's Moaning comes out in 1959 as well, which is so different from Ornette Coleman. You know, it's really harking back to call and response. It's hard bop, it's flowing, it's, you know, wonderfully accessible. And so I think it is really interesting to think of 1959 as that epoch-defining year.
Absolutely, and Cannonball himself, two-thirds of the members of the Kind of Blue band really wanted to zoom off into new directions and lead their own bands after Kind of Blue. And Cannonball Adderley was one. Cannonball Adderley was very much in that school that you were just talking about. He was such a wonderfully soulful player, and this is what he wanted to play. He wanted to play Mercy, Mercy, Mercy. He wanted to play music that, if people couldn't dance to it, they could listen to it and be emotionally so moved by it.
Mm. Yes, and I think that's what makes the band that performed in Kind of Blue so great, because they cover all the bases musically. They're so versatile, but they all have unique personalities, musical personalities. And so you explained about where jazz goes after Kind of Blue. It's ever more free, ever more careening, stratospheric, spiritual, for want of a better word, that always seems to come up if we talk about Coltrane or Albert Ayler or Pharoah Sanders. It seems to be spiritual is the only word that really captures it in some sense. Where does Billy Evans go after Kind of Blue?
Well, a lot of people accuse Bill Evans of having gone nowhere, really, or gone in the same direction, in only one direction after Kind of Blue. Bill Evans was very much married when he became a leader to the trio format, And continued to investigate that format, and to it's been argued to augment and deepen his relationship to harmony, to continue quiet but important musical change as he played in the trio format for the rest of his career. One of the wonderful, many wonderful musicians I interviewed for my book, Jean Baptiste, a terrific pianist and a musical genius in his own right, made a strong case with me that Jean Baptiste felt that Bill Evans had perhaps not overtly changed his musical path, but Baptiste feels that Evans dug down deeper, perhaps, than maybe even Miles or Coltrane. And he specifically cited this album that Evans made accompanying himself on the piano, this double-tracked album of Bill Evans playing with Bill Evans. No, nobody else did that. Nobody else had done it yet. Evans stayed with the trio format, and he had detractors, but an awful lot of musicians revere Bill Evans's playing all the way up to the end of his unfortunately, tragically truncated career. He died at age 51 in 1980, essentially of the abuse he had done to his body over the years.
I suppose Bill Evans might be unique of this holy trinity of jazz in that the fans, the musicians, and the aficionados who love Bill Evans's playing, as you said, love almost every note he played. Whereas fans of Miles and fans of Train argue about different phases and like some of it and not so much the rest of it. Where does John Coltrane go after Kind of Blue? What happens with Love Supreme, and what happens at the end of his life?
Well, Love Supreme is a great album, and it's a revered album. It's revered justly, I think. Coltrane felt that it was his tribute to God, and you can hear it that way, but you can hear it as a great jazz album, a great ballad album, a great lyrical album that sings and moves the spirit. But then Coltrane went beyond, and he went into stratospheres that of exploring the outward boundaries of the chords he was playing, intervals that had never been explored before, playing faster and more wildly, and taking his music into directions that sounded to a lot of listeners, and even schooled listeners, and even professional listeners, and even listeners who were other players and loved Coltrane's playing, began to feel alienated by how fast. Miles once called Coltrane the fastest, loudest saxophonist he had ever heard, and Coltrane doubled down on that in his career after A Love Supreme. And he began to explore interplanetary realms in his playing, to the extent that a lot of people listening to him felt that it almost sounded as though he was practicing on the bandstand, or playing wild scales on the bandstand, or just playing noise. And even people like McCoy Tyner, Coltrane's great pianist, began to feel that Coltrane was just playing for himself.
Part of reading your book, it makes the reader think. It's so interesting that this profusion of African American musical talent came out of the first half of the 20th century in America. How did this happen? How did poor young black kids, mostly with not an awful lot of worldly wealth or means for education,
Yes.
become so musically skilled to such a degree that we couldn't replicate that now? How did that happen?
Well, a lot of it had to do with oppression itself. There were very few occupations that, and we're talking primarily about young black men. There were several important women, black women in jazz, but the great preponderance were young black men who were as endangered and as limited, far more limited then, but as certainly as endangered as they are today. And so if a young black man was growing up in the 19-teens or 1920s or 1930s, his career possibilities were very strictly circumscribed. He could there were only so many professions he could go into without getting pushback from white society. One direction that a lot of young black men could go into was playing music. White society in the United States had always accepted this a tragic history of the United States, black people as minstrels, right? The black people were allowed to entertain. White America condescended to let black America entertain. And what these young black men did in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s very subversively was they began to take this old model of minstrelsy and turn it on its head. They didn't want to be minstrels anymore, but they did want to be musicians, and they found a way to create music that was, instead of about appeasing white society, it was about challenging white society. Again, back to Monk, we wanted a music that they couldn't understand. So there you have bebop. And suddenly you have this spectacle of young black men who are proud and upright and who aren't there to please anybody. You have Miles Davis turning his back on audiences and refusing to kowtow to anybody white or black. And he is sometimes punished for this.
And I have a penultimate question. What is it about Kind of Blue that still appeals to so many? Is it this island of quiet mystery that just seems to captivate generations and over again?
It's quiet. It's simple. There is a great degree of mystery in it. It is calming music. It's calming without being vacuous. It's not new age. it is not any age, really. It's not old age. It's not new age. It is this mystery. I don't want to duck the question, but there is a great mystery to Kind of Blue. And it's a timeless piece of work. And I think it is very difficult to find in art, whether it's visual art or musical art, or literature, work that is truly timeless. Timeless is an overused word. It's used these days for luxury goods, right? But I'm talking about literal timelessness. I'm talking about a piece of work that is not of its era. It is not of hard bop. It is not of free jazz. It is just its own thing. And it's its own thing that Miles had two primary inspirations. Again, he felt he failed with Kind of Blue. He was wrong. He didn't fail. It was a gigantic success. But his inspirations were, first of all, this ballet company and the much more simplified music they were playing, much more simplified in relation to the kind of jazz that jazz had been and Miles had been playing, many fewer chords. And the other inspiration he had was the memory of being a boy on his grandparents' farm in Arkansas, walking back home at night and hearing in the distance the ghostly sound of black church singers, gospel singers. So he wanted to get this ghostly, quiet sound and this simplified sound into Kind of Blue. Felt he had failed, but in fact he succeeded. There is a very positive sort of spookiness to the simplicity of Kind of Blue. And there certainly is arguably a musical simplicity. Take Kind of Blue's hallmark signature number, So What? It's a tune that is built on two chords. That's it. One chord, then the second chord, then back to the first. That's it. It is not All the Things You Are. It is a very simple and yet majestic piece of music, and Miles's solo in So What is one of the greatest melodies, not only in jazz, but in popular music.
I agree. And it's so hard to really do justice to the magic of music with words. So it's a brave undertaking to write 500 pages on it. But you
just
manage
under
it.
Five. Just under five.
Just under five. And how is and how has the reception been after publication? Has it been well received?
It's been wonderful. It's been wonderful. There have been a ton of reviews that I unimaginably positive. Certainly, there have been naysayers. It's inevitable. When you stick your neck out, you're going to get chopped sometimes. But I'm not going to quote the naysayers. The vast majority of reviews have been positive, and the book is also doing very well commercially, which is a delight to me.
Yes, best treat the naysayers as Miles would. But James, thank you so much for your time. It's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Max. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. If you're not a Reaction subscriber, please consider becoming one. For £8 a month or £80 annually, you'll receive Ian Martin's weekly newsletter, incisive analysis from the team's daily briefing straight to your inbox, and the best commentary from our columnists, including Adam Bolton, Tim Marshall, and Maggie Pagano. Until next time, thank you for listening.